At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Get ready for a little surf and turf action on Midnight Run Through, a podcast miniseries devoted to celebrating the 1988 contemporary classic action buddy comedy Midnight Run, written by George Gallo and directed by Martin Brest. Co-hosted by me, One Heat Minute Productions' Blake Howard.
And me, Jen Johans from Watch With Jen.
Each week, we'll explore the film we first bonded over when we became friends in 2019 by surfing through an incredible roster of guests from journalists to novelists and beyond who love it as much as we do. Digging into Serrano's finances and Alonzo Mosley's FBI files, come with us on Midnight Run Through as we crisscross the United States with the characters played by Robert De Niro, Charles Grodin, John Ashton, Yaphet Kotto, Dennis Farina, Philip Baker Hall, Joe Pantoliano, and company on screen. Today, our guests are...
Hi, I'm Charles. I'm Charles Hood. Wait, what do you need me to do? What do I have to do?
Just introduce yourself and maybe perfect. Plug the show.
Perfect.
I felt like perfect. We were in a help group for a minute. Yeah.
What do I do?
This is going great. This is going great.
I'm Charles Hood. I am a filmmaker and a podcast host, Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. And that's me.
Hi, I'm Adam Pally. I'm an actor and writer, and that's the only thing. That's it. I don't have a podcast.
But before we go any further, let's kick things off with Jack Welch's Old Turf with the ultimate question:
why were you so unpopular with the Chicago Police Department?
Because my wife is stripping the new captain.
Well, that's a good answer. That's a good answer. Adam, Charles, why is this one of your favorite movies? I know that for everyone that has a slightly different experience, Jen and I, it's a friendship foundational text for us. Jen, it was an awakening of her youth to be so attracted to a young Bobby De Niro. For me, it was kind of like obsession and of all things that are De Niro and particularly then going down the rabbit hole of like buddy comedies. But why do you guys love this movie so much?
I mean, I've loved it since I honestly don't even remember the first time I watched it. I just watched it all the time when I was a kid. It was just on HBO or whatever it was on TV. And I've watched it so many times. There's no recollection of when I started watching it. And, it's just stuck with me for so long. I think I kind of discovered it again, like 10 or 15 years ago, and then became obsessed with it and watched it like three times in the span of 1 week. And it's just, I don't know, it's a really special movie for so many reasons. I mean, just watching it again this week, like the command of tone that Martin Brest has in this movie is just, and I've listened to all the episodes of the show, so I know what everybody's talked about. And it's like, yeah, I mean, like Elfman's score, everybody talks about.
I have not.
We were going to quiz you, but.
There is a quiz.
Don't bother. I don't know what anyone else said. I didn't even Google you guys.
Who the hell are you?
Yeah. there's good. A million reasons, but let's hear from Adam.
No, similarly, I think like, you know, for people our age, I don't know what we're called. Like Jen, what are we called, Charles? Like Jen.
It's like Gen. Gen X/ elder millennials. I think
they call
it
geriatric. Isn't it geriatric millennials?
Geriatric millennials.
Like yes.
So yeah. I think for geriatric millennials, movies like were such a big deal because there weren't that many, you know, and like going to Blockbuster was a huge, huge deal on a Friday night, and picking out the movies that you were going to rent and watch and bring back, and you wouldn't just watch it once; you'd watch it like all weekend, and then you'd get it back again. So I feel like this movie, especially as I was like reaching puberty, like even though it was made the year I was born, I feel like it's one of those movies that was on in my house all the time, that as soon as my friends and I found it, because I think we found that it has the word fuck in it the most of any movie, at least of that time, for it held the record.
Yeah.
So it was like a big thing to get your hands on. And then it's just so funny and such a good movie that, like, similar to Charles, I don't remember the first time I saw it, but I can tell you that I've probably seen it a million times.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like one thing that I love too is like, sorry, I'm gonna be so scatterbrained on this, but it's like watching it.
That's
again,
good. That's what you want for a podcast.
I just like whenever I watch the movie, I always think it's so funny that like I love that it's like a movie from like the 1930s where like a single punch knocks people unconscious.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
like
this movie
happens over and over in this movie. Just unquestioned.
They even call
just
it
like
out.
One punch just knocks a person out every single time.
Marv even calls it out. Where he's like a couple times Marv is like, well, go to sleep. You know, and it's like, what is he doing to these people? But, you know, you needed that in these time periods. Like, it would be so hard to make a movie like this now with phones and stuff. You know, like.
Yeah.
And they're really like on the edge of it, and they're using it to the best of their ability with like tapping phones and, you know, like wires and location enabling and stuff. They're like right on the cusp of it, but it would be impossible to like, you'd have to, that would be the whole movie is outthinking the phones.
Yes.
Yeah.
And just making so that they couldn't be tracked on GPS the entire journey. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, it's almost like that whole Tony Scott Enemy of the State. I know Charles is a big Enemy of the State guy, but it's like Enemy of the State, it's like they get someone on a surveillance footage or something like that, someone's hacking here and all, we can see them here and we can track them here, and they rented a car from here and they use their credit card. It's like all of that stuff is so nice that you don't even have to worry about it. You're like, no, we're just in a world where these people can't be found. And I think people our age still remember what that was like. I remember not having a phone. Like, I remember not having a phone at all. Like, we had a home.
Getting the phone number based on listening to the, like, the sound that they make. Yeah, yes. It's like, oh, that's a five.
Yeah. Yep.
Now people will be like, what the hell is he doing?
Yeah. Well, also, I think this movie also does something now that you could do, but people don't, which is they shot, for the most part, I mean, I think there's a couple sets with Dennis Farina, but for the most part, this movie is shot on location in America.
Yeah.
Like, there are major comedic set pieces in New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, like Texas. I don't know if they fake Texas, because there's really nothing, no need to, but like
Arizona. The one fake is the river sequence. Part of that was shot in New Zealand because, again, Adam, to your point, they were shooting all over the country. And because it was taking a long time for them to shoot, they missed a season. So they were like, oh, where we were going to shoot is now winter, so we need to go somewhere else. So they flew
the entire 5 minutes of winter. Yeah.
They flew to New Zealand and then came back.
Yeah, no, totally. And like, you, that's part of the magic of this movie too, though.
Yes.
Similar to, this movie reminds me so much of Blues Brothers and Once Upon a Time in America. It was like it was a big rush of these movies around this time.
Yeah.
And like, this movie, better than all, shows you America at the time, like in such a weird, beautiful way that you're really there. You're really in Las Vegas.
Yes.
You know, which is such a contrast to the cutback to Chicago, you know, and it was like, it really does give you that sense of like, how's he going to make it there by midnight? Which they also stretch out. It's like, which midnight is he talking about?
Yeah.
You know, like by the end of it, you're like, this has been a week and a half.
It's midnight a little ways away. Nice stretch.
Building off what Adam was saying, like seeing Amarillo, like I'd never seen a place like that in my life when I was that little. I was like, no idea. It was so interesting to see this other sides of the country. You know, it was amazing.
Yeah, like the gas, the plane scene.
Yeah.
You know, like so wild. Yeah. Like that little town where there's just four people. It's like, you know, that doesn't exist anymore.
No.
Like even the smallest towns have like Starbucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Because they show up there and they don't have a phone, right? There's no phone.
Right. There's no phone. There's just a plane.
there's no phone. They have a plane. But also, like, who's reading a script?
That checks out. Yeah.
Who's reading a comedy script? And Adam, this would be like targeted at someone like you is like, who's reading a comedy script where they're like, okay, Adam, what we need you to do is we need you to fly a biplane and this other actor is going to wrestle you out of it while it's moving. And it's going to be one of the funniest scenes in the movie. Like, it just doesn't, there's no world where that's,
well, that's
exists.
The reason though, but that's the reason though, like, you know, this movie is like the pinnacle of buddy movies, you know. Yes. It's like referenced all the time. Hollywood's been trying to make it and remake it forever, and there are versions of it, you know, there's like 48 Hours and whatever. There's never been a version where the two buddies are the bad guys like they are in this movie, which I really love.
Yes,
because it's like lets that it excuses all the times Robert De Niro just like hotwires a car and so much by the end of it, Charles Grodin is like, another car, great. It's
like, you know, add some more felonies. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think like what this movie does so well is its casting is, especially at the time, like it is so relevant to Hollywood and who those actors are as personalities.
Yes,
that it was able to, it kind of was almost, I would say, borderline reality television. And that was the reason that America, I think that's the reason that it really was revolutionary in a way, because it was the first time, like the reason it's so big is because Robert De Niro was the biggest movie star on the planet.
Yeah.
And he was so serious.
Yes.
And so when they paired him with Charles Grodin, who was one of the biggest comedic stars on the planet, it was like Hollywood bubbled, you know. It was like, oh, we're gonna make De Niro. It was like his first time doing something like that. And then so I feel like that gives it this like undercurrent of energy that obviously when you rewatch it you don't know because you're not of that time and you don't understand, but like that is why it's so good. It's the tone is great, the direction is great, but it's really De Niro.
I mean, yeah, the two of them together and Grodin's delivery is just like, there's so many lines in that movie that when I was watching it again, I was like, that would, there's no way that would read funny on the page at all.
I'll have tea.
Like when he's like, gee, that's too bad. I really like you. Or yeah, I'll have tea. Like those things, like those aren't funny lines. Like, but they're like some of the biggest jokes and some of the biggest laughs when I'm watching the movie. And it's all just Grodin's delivery.
I mean, What's chorizo? I just love him. It's just so fun.
And then
like,
later
so
when he
funny.
Brings it back and he says to De Niro that he wants the chorizo and he gets mad and he's like, chorizo, that's what I want. I want chorizo.
Yeah. But that's a, like, I think that's great. I mean, to me, the real marvel of this script / movie is like how much it feels improvised because of how and what you would consider to be bad improvising.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like Robert De Niro stammers on every line. He repeats it 4 or 5 times. He, you know, which is like not great improvising because it adds no information. It's like kind of stalling. You know what I mean? But for some reason, the script is so crystal clear. And I don't think a lot of it was improvised. I think that like a lot of it was just on the page, and those guys are amazing. And like, you know, all those interactions of like, I'm not hungry. Yeah, I'm hungry. No, you're not hungry. Oh, he's hungry. Oh, you're hungry now. It's like, that is amazing timing, editing, acting. Like, it's just so good. It doesn't add much information on the, like, so on the page, I don't know if that's there, but in this movie, it works better than any other movie I've ever seen, you know?
Yeah, when you got De Niro doing that.
Yeah.
There's nothing better.
Yeah, but he's great at it too. He's really, and like, that's what makes me think that maybe it's not all improvised, because like their timing, and especially when they're on the train, the first one where he locks him in the bathroom, that is the timing in those conversations are so well done that it's either like uber rehearsed. And Charles, you know how like, you know, we've done stuff like that where it's like you just rehearse it to death that the dialogue feels like it's improvised,
right?
Or it actually is De Niro being like, oh, he's hungry.
Jack, I think this is illegal. Jack, I don't think you can keep a person in a bathroom like this. It's very claustrophobic in here. There's
yeah, no it is. Well, I'll tell you what, when we get to LA, you can tell the prison psychiatrist all about it.
There's no air. There's no ventilation in here. I told you I was claustrophobic. Come on. What do you think I'm going to do? Jump off a train moving 90 miles an hour? Jack? Jack? Jack?
Thanks. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, good.
Sit down.
Thanks. Very, very kind of you. Nice. Much better. Thank you. Good.
What are you doing?
What am I doing? Arithmetic.
Arithmetic. Maybe I can help you. I am an accountant.
Well, you know, I was thinking after I turn your ass in and collect my money, I'm going to open up a nice little coffee shop.
How much exactly are you getting for me?
I don't think that's any of your concern, but I'll tell you just to tell you. $100,000.
$100,000? Does that mean you take $100,000 and let me go?
Not by a long shot.
$200,000?
I never took a payoff in my life, and I'm not going to start with someone like you.
Why not?
Because you're a fucking criminal, and you deserve to go where you're going, and I'm going to take you there. And if I hear any more shit out of you, I'm going to fucking bust your head, and I'm going to put you back in that fucking hole, and I'm going to stick your head in the fucking toilet bowl, and I'm going to make it stay there.
I have to tell you, a restaurant is a very tricky investment. More than half of them go under within the first 6 months. If I were your accountant, I'd have to strongly advise you against it.
You would, huh? Yeah. Well, you're not my accountant.
No, I mean, if I were your accountant...
I told you, I took you out here...
No, I'm just saying that it's a very, very tricky business. And if I were your accountant, I would really strongly have to advise you against it as an accountant.
You're not my accountant.
I realize I'm not your accountant.
Come in, talk to okay.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it was like, I mean, it's what I love, like working with you, Adam, is like, yes, it's very rehearsed, but there's always in every take, you can just throw in a little extra word or a little extra something that just adds so much more, or just like a little phrase snuck in between everything that's very well rehearsed. And I feel like that's probably what this maybe was. I mean, I saw, yeah. I went to I mean, the Q&A.
I've worked with De Niro.
Oh, that's right.
And like, to me, just from like working with him, I think this movie is one of the best marriages of like actor director, like the trust between leading man director in this movie, mm-hmm. and Charles Grodin, because he's a specific kind of actor as well. You know, like when I was a kid, he used to annoy me. Like,
because he was something... the old dad in our movies, lots of the movies that we saw him
right,
in Adam, right?
And he was just so like, great, and he was so good, you know. But there,
Beethoven,
there's something like when you see a lot of what De Niro does, his style or like whatever is this kind of repetition, you know, where he'll say something three or four ways before he moves on to the next thing, and so that combination with Martin's direction. It's like having a tool and knowing exactly what to do with it.
Yeah.
And I think that it just showcased, it's like, he just knew how to showcase De Niro perfectly. And some people don't, as you can see by other movies, you know? Yeah.
Well, and a few years ago, I went to the Q&A that PTA did with Martin Brest. After, it was a screening of Midnight Run. And they were just talking about his career trajectory, and Martin Brest said something along the lines of, I'm probably going to butcher it, but he said, like, when I did Going in Style, like, I was so strict about making it in exactly the way I storyboarded it, and everything was exactly the way it was written and everything. And then he said he went and made Beverly Hills Cop, and it was the exact opposite. And it was just completely improvised, and he was so loose and just completely changed his style of filmmaking. And then he said when he made Midnight Run, he was able to sort of merge the two and figure out, like, this is going to be exactly the way I want to do it, but it's also, we're going to build within it. It's like a certain amount of improvisation And so I thought, yeah, it's just, it all comes together. I rewatched all three of those this week, and it's just like, I mean, I love those other two movies, but Midnight Run really does feel like a culmination of all of it. Just, it's such an,
yeah, it feels like his best work. I mean, like, there are scenes, like, you can tell the scene where Grodin is acting like a cop to get the counterfeit money. Yeah. You can tell that that scene, there's a lot of improv in that scene, especially when he starts talking to the extra. Like, the extra is like dying laughing, this old guy. Like, you can see it, you know what I mean? And that conversation is such a good like, you can tell that's improvised, where Charles Grodin's like, I think he says something like, like, you see anybody suspicious,
you
see anybody suspicious. No, I think it's, do you see anybody suspicious, yes, around here? And then the guy goes, no. And he goes, do you live around here? And then the guy goes about a mile down the road. And so then Charles Grodin like culminates it with, well, then I'd say there's some suspicious people here. And it's like, the guy is like dying laughing, you know? And so like, I'm sure stuff like that is improvised, but the way that the two of them are together is really like, I bet you there was a ton of rehearsal. That's what it has the feeling to me. Don't you think, Charles?
Yeah. Well, and there's really nothing better than a two shot with two great actors playing great characters. Like the two shot on the just the two shot on the bus. Like, talk about
smoking scenes. Yeah.
Like, talk about knowing when to stay out of the way. Like, I was watching it this past time. It's like there's two different scenes. Like, there's a scene of the two of them on the bus, and then it cuts to another scene, I think maybe Dennis Freen or something, and then comes back to them on the bus. It's the same shot for two different scenes, the same two shot.
And you think, how could they not have gone under their allotted days?
Yeah.
How are they going to New Zealand?
I mean, that's just the restraint there, and to let those two just play off each other is just amazing.
Yeah. He's the best at that, I think, you know, as far as these comedies go. I mean, you look at his other work, he really is good at that. He never puts his own filmmaking above the comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just it's that command of tone. Like, it's really amazing. Like, the music, like Elfman's music, like, you could easily put something more serious sounding on this, and it could, you could try to put more dangerous sounding, whatever, like urgency in the when the helicopter's shooting them in the New Zealand scene. But it's like this fun music. And so you're just having a blast with them, even though they're
Blues
in danger
Brothers.
And getting shot at.
Yeah.
It's very indicative of Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, dun, 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 dun. It's almost like the Price is Right music, it's like honky tonk. But that was big at the time.
It's like a Western.
Especially. It really is. Yeah. It has, it even feels like television inspired. I believe at the time, what was that big show with the Daisy Duke shorts and the
Dukes of Hazzard.
Flag. I feel like Dukes of Hazzard had been around, and like, you know, it was like, there was this idea that you could lighten the mood. And I think that also comes from both characters being somewhat unlikable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, they're not precious with these characters' lives. And like, that is something that you don't get in modern day comedy. You would never have a modern day comedy that follows two criminals.
Yeah.
Well, he's not a criminal.
He is a criminal. He's a bounty hunter. Criminal.
But he is a dick. I mean, we haven't even brought up the scene that everybody brings up, which is, you know, when he goes to visit his ex-wife and sees his daughter.
I love that scene. Yeah.
This last time watching, I have two daughters, I just bawled my eyes out.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, it's
it's a tough scene. I mean, my favorite part is when she comes out to offer him the money.
Yes.
That's the best. That's the best. It's like she wants to do anything, and he turns her down. He's like, but that's the most likable part of the movie for him.
Yeah.
If he doesn't turn her down,
then he is a dick. Then he's a real piece of shit. Then he's a real.
Then you kind of don't care if he lives or dies.
Yeah. I was going to say that scene you were bringing up too, talking about money, as far as showing the development of the characters, like the way that Grodin and De Niro, their characters are starting to trust each other. I mean, there's that hilarious thing where they're looking at, have you had any 20s? And then he looks and De Niro, you know, hits the hand on the, like, oh, he's been here. And just the way they're starting to play off each other. And that scene at the house, you need that to kind of help their relationship as well. Yeah.
Well, there's this moment where De Niro, they're walking to the house, and I don't think he says I'm nervous, but I think it's played that way, right? It's played like, I don't know what's gonna happen. And Charles Grodin says to him, this is gonna be good for you. Which is like such an odd choice of words and dialogue between two people who are strangers to each other. You know, it's like,
yeah,
I really liked it.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, De Niro's incredible in that scene, but it's also fascinating to watch Grodin's reactions through the whole scene too, and how awkward he feels in this, and how he, and then, when they go back to the car afterwards, and it's like De Niro's like already a changed man. He's like helping Grodin into the car and like putting his tucking his jacket in before
tucking
he closes
his jacket
the door.
In. Yeah. I like that. But then I also love the moment, which comes after that, where they go to the thing and the credit cards are canceled.
Tickets to Los Angeles, please.
Still gonna make our schedule?
Don't worry, I'll get you there on time. Don't have any illusions.
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 I'm sorry, sir, this card's been canceled.
Huh? That's been canceled? I'm sorry, that's a mistake. Would you please try it again?
I checked it twice, sir.
Please try it again. Please try it again.
Should pay the bill?
Shut up.
I'm sorry, sir, it's been canceled.
Ma'am, that is impossible. I pay my bills. There is no way that could be canceled. Shut up. Please.
It's canceled, sir. Would you like to try another credit card?
I don't have any other credit cards. Please, would you just try that again?
No.
All right.
Yeah.
And and Charles Grodin is playing off of the woman saying that the cards are canceled.
Yes.
Right.
And it's so good the way he does it, because he's not going, help me. You know, he's not like, no, he's just like,
he's amused.
Like,
yeah.
Like, they're a couple, and he's like, embarrassed. He's like, oh, my guy. It's so well played. It's so funny.
We'll be back after this quick break.
Adam, you used a great turn of phrase about Martin Brest knowing the tool that De Niro is, like using him to perfection. But I think that Grodin, like this thing is like two cogs and they both have to work in such harmony. And Grodin can just do any, he's like the perfect harmony every time. Like that scene could be played so different and he just does exactly what is required.
I think De Niro, I think Robert De Niro works best with another straight man.
Yeah.
I think Robert needs like utmost reality around him to do the job. And I think if you look at his most successful comedies, like Ben Stiller is a very good approximation of Charles Grodin.
Yeah.
Yes. So
it's like they're played real. Everything is real. The frustration is muted. We're not outlandish. We're not over the top. We're in these horrendous situations, but we're down to earth and we're grounded and we're played real. And that lets De Niro really shine. I think when De Niro struggles in comedies, it's when the person he's working with, like William Shatner, is like huge.
Yeah.
And Robert can't find his like footing. Jerry Lewis. I mean, I love King of Comedy, but like infamously they didn't get along. Like it's like, you know, I think it's like when Robert feels bullshit on you, he's like, nah, I'm not gonna do that, you know.
So how much bullshit did he detect on you, Adam?
quite a bit, I would say.
I did make him talk about Midnight Run for 3 hours.
No, I think we got along. I think he liked me. I really do think he liked me. I gave him his space, you know, like he's like really needs his space. But I think again, like similarly, that movie is crazy that we're in together is crazy and big and whatever. But
you didn't let your process get in his way.
No, and Charles, you know I have an extensive process. But it's I got to do so much work to get on camera. Mostly plastic surgery is what I mean.
There's another moment that I really am obsessed with that I really want to talk about. It's kind of a whole scene, but there's one moment in particular. So when De Niro is when he's taken in by the FBI at the end of the like second act, there's basically like 3.5 minutes. I counted it this time. I like clocked it. 3.5 minutes on like one medium shot of De Niro where he's just at the station where he's making phone calls. And then they go to like reverse shots on the other end of the phone calls, but it's really just De Niro in this one medium shot. Again, the restraint of Martin Brest. It's all you need. It's so good. But watching De Niro as he figures out the whole thing, like that Marvin made a deal with Serrano's, then he calls Serrano's thug. And then the best moment though is like after he hangs up and he looks back and forth in the station, he's like figuring out in the moment what he's going to do, Dwayne, what his plan is going to be. And he kind of looks hyped. Back and then he looks forward and he looks hyped back up. And he looks forward
and he does. And
then he finally like realizes what he's going to do. And then it's just like, yeah. I can watch that moment on repeat. It's so fucking great.
There's a lot of like stuff like that. He also does one when he's walking alone. They have a shot of him. He's walking alone and he turns back around real quick. He almost looks directly into camera.
Oh, nice.
You know, that shot I'm
so good.
Talking about.
Yeah,
and it's like because he's hyped up, he's putting it together. He's like, "What am I gonna do?" Turns around real quick. It's like
he's so
you know,
funny.
It almost feels like a mistake, but it's great. It's great. Yeah,
and him playing off the kid on the airplane when he's making the fake ID.
Oh. Yeah, that's a funny scene. Well, that's something. The script is so well written. You know, it reminds me of Die Hard in a way. Like,
yeah.
Where it's just like all these little, it's just so simple and well written and well done. The plane stuff, I'm afraid of flying, like all this stuff is like, it just pays off. Everything pays off. And then the tone of it is so special because of the way that they speak to each other that it really is like the seminal, I think, R-rated comedy.
Yeah. And so they can't, released the same day as Die Hard.
Yeah, they released the same day.
The same day.
Can you fucking imagine? Mm-hmm. Jesus.
Yeah. What a time.
And
to be
just
alive.
Like Die Hard 2, like just like Die Hard, it's such a well-drawn ensemble. Like just so
yeah, it's
many
so well cast.
Amazing characters.
So well
the casting. Yeah, Yaphet Kotto with his looks that he's making.
Yeah.
Dennis and Farina, I feel like at his absolute best.
Who's the guy behind Yaphet Kotto on the left? Who's in
he's in Die Hard as well, I think. Is
Who watches this movie and says, okay, now Philip Baker Hall, Sydney, that's the guy I want to make a movie about. Like you have to respect
one guy.
The level of
there's one
you have to
guy.
Respect the level of insanity from Paul Thomas Anderson being like, oh yeah. That's the character. I'm gonna make a movie about that guy. But like I could see why he loves this movie because it feels like a Jonathan Demme movie. Like the whole ensemble and all the characters. Like the only thing missing is like some live bands that they could have encountered in different bars or casinos along the way. Like that, then it's a Jonathan Demme movie, you know. And that's
but it's like there's something Demme. About not doing that makes it even more of a comedy,
right?
You know, and I think like that's to me like that's what I really why it hits me harder than a lot of those Jonathan Demme movies is that like this to me is like almost John Hughes. It's like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah.
Is what comes after this. You know what I mean? Like Steve Martin's film career is a direct progression of Charles Grodin's work in Midnight Run.
Yeah.
And I feel like that line, that drawn line is why this movie always does it for me. You know, because it's like those movies don't exist. There are no more comedies like that anymore. So this is you watch this. That's why every Friday night you go. I remember the Blockbuster cover of this, like almost as much as that Michael Douglas movie, Hard Rain.
Black Rain.
Baby.
Hard Rain's another one.
Babe.
Yeah.
But like, remember, like there's like certain boxes that you just remember at the video store. You know, you're like
both of them had the leather jacket thing too.
I mean.
How many? Yeah, you got Douglas. And anyway, have you guys all seen, got to do a little aside because I'm associated with Black Rain, but have you guys all been on YouTube and checked out the Babe supercut for Black Rain?
Oh, it's very good. It's sensational.
You need to do that.
No.
It's every time. I kind of always considered it like a homoerotic love story, and I'm not alone. Somebody put together a supercut
for sure.
Every time they say the word babe or call each other babe. I love it. Yes.
What's happened, babe?
What do you see, baby?
Baby, I hope somebody's paying you to wear that goddamn suit.
It's $85 a pop, babe. Grab your dick and count to infinity, babe.
You guys ready?
Yeah, baby. You okay, babe?
Thanks, babe.
You never know, babe.
It's done, babe.
911, babe. 911.
You seatbelt tight, babe. Here we go, babe. We got the local heat. Hey, Charlie, get your map out, will you, babe? What's happening, baby?
How's your lunch, babe?
We got good news for you, babe.
Come here, baby.
Oh, babe, wait, it's still moving in my mouth. I am taking the silverware, babe, all right?
Hey, babe.
You're going to have to lose the Kmart time, babe. It's a fire hazard.
If you get hit enough, throw your hat out of it, babe. What I say, babe? Baby, what I say? Come on, baby. See about me. You and me, baby. Come on, babe. You want to play? You and me.
Good move.
Hey!
Master, rise and shine, babe.
Yeah, and Yaphet Kotto had no idea it was a comedy.
I love that.
And also, Adam, the guy, the same guy that's in Die Hard that you're thinking of, he plays an FBI special agent, and he's also standing behind Yaphet Kotto, is Robert Davi. That's
Robert Davi, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Davi.
Wow.
Yeah, he's like, he's the guy.
Oh, Vietnam, yeah.
Yes. How did I not catch him in Midnight Run?
He's standing behind. He's standing behind him. He's just there. Left, I think. Yeah.
Wow. Every scene with the affect.
Does he doesn't have a line, does he?
I don't think he
has
a line.
Yeah, he does have a line. He does have a line. There's a couple lines. Yeah, he's just like, they're coming from Amarillo or whatever. Like, he brings him a telegram. But I mean, I think this movie stands the test of time, similar to Die Hard 1. Yeah. Like, I think it's just like, they're both classics to me, you know?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, absolutely. And I think it's only in like the scarcity of movies like this that you relish how much everything works, you know, how perfect it is and how calibrated it is. Mm-hmm. It's just like, and also lots of contemporary movies look like that because of, you know, shooting on green screens and things like that, things look terrible. And so when you look at this movie and you're like, oh, that's New York City, or that's LAX, or that's, you know, that's Chicago. Like, they're there. You can't fake any of this stuff. It looks right. It feels right. And it just, and especially now, as you know, some of us are physical media psychos. I know Charles is as well. Like, when you're a physical media psycho, when everything gets upgraded onto 4K and you watch these things again and everything looks like as good, or if not better than it ever looked at a cinema, you're like, the Midnight Runs of the world are the movies that look, that like haven't aged a day. They just look perfect. The only thing is, they don't have phones. They don't have stupid phones or computers or those things, but the tactile feeling of everything is so, like, you can reach out and touch it. It's amazing.
But you see that, like, all the like auteur filmmakers, you know, Wes Anderson and Paul Thomas Anderson and now Alexander Payne, and none of them make movies set now.
Yes.
No. They're all making old period pieces before their cell phones.
Yes.
It's just like, that's where you go. Cause like, how do you tell a story now with fucking cell phones?
Mm-hmm. Someone will do it. Someone will do it. No, someone will do it. Someone will do it.
I feel like it's Soderbergh and Fincher are the two, I think, like, kind of leading the way. They're the ones who are like, we're going to do it. Yeah, fuck it.
Yeah.
Let's make a movie, Adam, where we'll just shoot you just on your phone.
Honestly, it should be a love story. Because I'm in love with my phone. That's all I want to do.
I guess Spike Jones did make that
movie already. I'm still telling Charles, Adam, that if he's making some kind of action movie or a thriller, it needs to be somewhere set in Australia, get some tax breaks. And so bring Adam Pally to New Zealand, get him to jump into Midnight Runs.
I would love that. I've never done like real action, like action where like the whole movie is like, what's this set piece? It's gonna take 3 months to shoot because it's like me falling off a building or whatever. Like, I really want to do that, but also I don't think anyone wants to see it.
There's two people on this show that want to see it. I want to see it.
Well, yeah, then you guys can finance it. You throw me up a desk.
I have to ask also, because we haven't really touched on many of the side characters, so I just want to focus on like how perfect Farina is and how perfect like Joey Pants is and like how perfect Yaphet is, like all the guys who are in this movie who aren't that central core duo, and like, oh, John Ashton as Marvin, we've spoken a little bit about Marvin, but like all these people that are as part of this movie are just so incredible for their bits. And that's a lost art, I think, to Adam, that you would probably notice, is like, it's only rarely that you get an amazing ensemble where someone who is a serious actor just comes in to do like 10 minutes of work on a day or a day's work and then leaves.
I think the reason for that, honestly, is because, you know, it kind of started with like Ocean's 11 or whatnot, but like big casts are now like, look at Dune, right? Like Dune's supporting actor is like Josh Brolin.
Yeah.
You know, and so there aren't many character actors that you can reference as like, oh, that guy was great in this and great in that, or she was amazing in this and amazing at that. Because if it's a movie and it's big business, just on the budgets alone, even small parts are going to be given to people with giant followings that can boost up the, that can hold up a tentpole, you know? So I think what has happened subsequently is that you have a lot of the great character actors moving to TV, but then when they're in TV, they become the leads.
Yeah.
Because they're the best actors. So you can't book those people in your movies. So like, for an example, someone that Charles and I work with all the time, Tony Hale. Tony Hale is one of the best actors I've ever worked with. He's an Emmy winner for Best Supporting Actor. Mm-hmm. And probably if his career had was 20 years ago, he would be the villain in every major action franchise on the planet, right? He would be the next like...
Bond villain. Yeah.
Yes. He would be Alan Rickman.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, truly, that's what he would be. But he's the lead of a... He has to be the lead of a television show.
Yes.
For 14 months a year. And so he can't do that. It's like that kind of separation of the business and stuff has made it where these character actors in the big, like you said, Midnight Run was like the biggest movie of the year coming out, right?
Yes.
And they didn't have Dan Aykroyd playing Marv.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think like that is a big difference now. And if you were to make Midnight Run today, you better believe that the Marv role would be like The Rock.
Yeah. And it'd be more than one punch. I mean,
yeah.
Equal number of punches. Yes.
Yeah.
Every fight scene would be like 15 minutes. This movie would go for 3 hours. That's the other thing that this movie has.
Yeah.
So perfectly attuned to its time. It just goes, goes and goes and goes.
Yeah. But like, it's true. Like Marv would be played by Jamie Foxx. And he would get be getting paid more than, you know, the two actors who would be like Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman.
I want to cry.
Originally, they did, and they wanted Cher originally instead of Charles Grodin, and like George Gallo, and it was thinking, you know, do we really want to see Robert De Niro like, you know, threaten and handcuff a woman to a toilet and stuff. So they got that idea of Cher.
Wow. Yeah. But like, still, like, there were way bigger stars than Grodin at the time.
For sure. Yeah. He had to keep auditioning.
Yeah, he had to keep auditioning. But Adam, you said the great thing, which now completely doesn't exist, which is like Grodin was a favorite on Carson, like the biggest show in the world. He would just go on for like 10 minutes and kill every couple of months, even if he didn't have a project on, and people knew his name. They're like, oh, he's one of the funniest
ornery
people.
Guy.
Yeah, he's angry. He's like, so great.
That's the trajectory of comedy stars, right? Like they're, you know, like they always come from lesser known places and blow it up on their first movie, like the Will Ferrells, Zach Galifianakis's, you know, Sandler's a little different, but Eddie Murphy, like that's the standard trajectory for the TV to film. But Grodin was older at the time.
Yeah.
You know, he was in his 30s. It was like his you know, star had already kind of like gone like this. And after this, like you can't really point to a ton of Grodin's work as superstar level, you know, of his own choosing.
Yeah,
but you know, I think that that's interesting. I find that to be very, very interesting and telling of like what would happen to a Midnight Run today. I don't think you would get like if you want if if you wanted to have everybody see Midnight Run today, I would cast like Leonardo DiCaprio and Charlie Day.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But they would never do that.
Yeah.
Or Seth Rogen or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Or I would, yes, I would want, or I would want to see like,
who would be the Yaphet Kotto? I was just trying to think that.
Oh, but those roles are like, forget it. That's Yaphet Kotto. Yaphet Kotto would be Kevin Hart.
That's true. Yes.
You'd want it to be Michael Shea so funnier. Much, but it would be Kevin Hart. Or you'd want it to
but that's the thing is like, it would not be cast well today.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, I mean, it's the holy grail for comedic actors, though, to get booked in Midnight Run.
Even
whatever
Joey,
your generation's Midnight Run is.
Even Joey Pants' role, what a killer role! Like, just it's just a great.
And that's
role.
That's where he did that role like 50 times after that because he was so good at it.
Yeah, they're like, oh yeah, we got this.
Billy
guy.
Crystal and Gregory Hines. I'm blanking on the name, but. Yeah, where he had like a mohawk.
Bad Boys.
Well, he does Bad Boys later. Yeah, which is another George Gallo script.
Let me think.
Right.
I mean, Bad Boys is like closest to this because they're two amazing actors and comedians.
Yes.
But that again.
Running Scared.
Yes.
Running Scared.
Yes.
Yes. Good one. And I talked about Running Scared online and Joe Pantoliano. Found the tweet somehow and like shared it, and he talked about how much fun that was, like playing these kind of roles. And so I think he missed it for sure. Yeah, it was a really good era.
Oh yeah, the best. I mean, George Gallo is the greatest.
I love what you just said before, Adam. It's like it is a holy grail. Like you can't. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've had our midnight
and every.
Run.
Well, we have, which is was like every 10 years Hollywood does it. They're like, let's get. You know, hot comedic actors and throw them on the road.
Yeah.
I mean, I made one, you know, and it just wasn't very good. Like they, you know, and so that's part, it's like part of the Hollywood pantheon of like, what's this movie like? It's like Midnight Run. What does that mean? Well, it means it's, you know, two men who can't emote, who learn who learn something they need from each other on the road.
Yeah.
You know, due date.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I remember that one. Mm-hmm.
But that
The Hangover.
Oh yeah, The Hangover's good. Well, I was just gonna say recently what I think of is that has similar energy and also was sort of received the same and is aging really well in our generation is like The Nice Guys. Like
I love that movie.
The great movie.
But again, that movie's a different time period.
Yeah, again, set in another completely different time and detached. And everyone's like, why isn't there a sequel to The Nice Guys? And it's the same conversation we're having with Midnight Run. It's like, why aren't there sequels? And we're like, well, actually, there are.
They can't get Russell Crowe to pass the health insurance.
Oh, Russ, he's living his best life. He's riding scooters in LA. He's riding scooters through Rome. What a legend. but there are terrible Midnight Run sequels.
Yes, made for the USA Network.
With Christopher McDonald.
With Christopher McDonald. Yeah. Did you know this, Adam?
I never watched any of that, no.
I haven't seen them. I'm afraid
I watched
to.
One and it was, yeah.
I watched three in a day as research for this show and I hated myself for it. So, I would just recommend not.
Wow.
They just don't have the same. It's.
I can't believe they made so many.
Yeah, they made like three in the same year. They're all like TV movie length. You know, one of them has Jeffrey Tambor in it. You know, they've just got like these weird casts. They're okay, but the problem is that they've kind of got like Chris McDonald's playing Jack as a bit of a buffoon. Like he's not as accomplished or as smart as the Jack that we see in the movie. So he's always kind of getting put one over on him. And it kind of like, it doesn't. I don't know. It's just not the same.
Yeah.
It's not the same.
Well, Jack is not very smart. Like Jack, that's the thing that's so great about Jack is like that line where Charles Grodin's like, "You're the dumbest bounty hunters ever." Like, he is talking to Jack. He's talking about Jack. Like,
yes.
But I think De Niro again, like that is casting. Like De Niro is just like playing at this like way that, you know what I mean? That chin up in the air. It's like it's the antithesis of being bad, even though he is. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
I feel like that's why it works so well.
He and John Ashton are like, you know, two sides of the same coin. They're both like, they're both very smart and good at what they do, but they're also kind of idiots.
Yes.
I think De Niro's a little like, bit, I love a little bit above him. Like, De Niro does get the better of him probably more often, but, you know, John Ashton gets the better of him sometimes as well. Drives up and hits him with the car door, and you know, I was standing there looking like an idiot, just like, "Oh, is that Marvin?" When he gets hit,
when he cancels the cards,
yeah,
that's the best. That's like, because that's like smooth and cool, and you're like, "Oh, this guy actually is good at what he's doing."
Yeah,
yeah. Let's go ahead and like, pull those cards. Yeah.
I love that they're like frenemies. Like, they hate each other, but they also love each other. Always like,
see you in L.A.
Like, they're just always they're always getting the better of each other, fucking each other over, and then just being like, "Yeah, I'll see you in L.A. Watch your cigarettes with him, Jack." You know, like,
oh God, right. The best. And I'm glad they didn't kill off Ashton like they thought they were going to.
Yeah. They were going to? No.
Yes.
It's that tone. Like, they just.
No.
I don't know if it was Martin Brest or whoever made that decision.
I think it was Martin and George together. That's not right for that tone. We can't kill Marvin. We can't.
They need him at the airport at the end. They were having trouble figuring out how to play that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you watch Beverly Hills Cop, and like, there's like squibs going off, people are getting brutally killed, like, and that's not what you see in this movie.
No.
Very different.
One of the things I wanted to say about the movie is that, again, script is so airtight. It reminds me a lot of Breaking Bad in a lot of ways, because the whole point of it is to get the viewer into these situations where you're like, well, they can't get out, this is the end. And that happens like 3 or 4 times, even at like minute 50. You're like, you know, they're surrounded by shooters and the police, and you're like, they're literally getting arrested. You're like, well, this is the end of the movie now. How could the cops are holding them? There's a gunman on the thing, and then all of a sudden Marv pulls up, and it's like, it just works so well. And then they call it back with the discs at the end. It's like, you know, again, they don't, I think part of the reason that you don't see comedies like this is because they don't spend the time making the script as good as the action movies like this.
Yes. Yeah.
And if the script was as good as those great movies and is airtight, and like Charles said, everyone got out of the comedian's ways, I think you would get a lot more stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, speaking to Charles as a last point before we maybe lose you.
Sorry.
I had it pointed out to me that Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning feels a lot like Midnight Run, because the Grace character is like the Duke who's running away constantly and taking them into a situations that you possibly can't get out. And I was only talking to Clay Keller, one of our previous guests, who looked at the poster on my wall and was like, you know, that movie in Midnight Run, they share like a lot, like the guys who made Mission Impossible clearly like Midnight Run and like that idea that someone doesn't want to be caught and keeps taking them into these escalating situations, and there's no way they could possibly get out, and they get out, and then they get out again, and then they get out again. And it's like, and just talking to you now, Adam, and you're like, the action movies do it better in some respects, but there's not a comedic element like a Charles Grodin that is that person that's trying to run away.
But I think again, the important thing of that is that the comedic element is not just Charles Grodin. It's Charles Grodin with Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's what's missing, is that like perfect alchemy. And now it's like, this would be John Cena and Zac Efron. You know, or like,
stop coming up with combinations, Adam.
Every combination hurts. It stings.
It's true though. It's true.
Yeah, no, because like, you've got Charles Grodin against a St. Bernard. It's not the same. When you get Charles Grodin and De Niro, like, it's a very special chemistry there for sure.
Completely. Yeah. And I think it's like, it all has to do with that and then an amazing script.
Yeah.
Kind of like the perfect match of you guys today. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
The perfect chemistry. Yeah.
No one has ever said that about us, Charles. Even in our film.
By the way, I want to see a Mission Impossible movie with Charles Grodin. By the way, that sounds excellent. Can we bring the Charles Grodin element into Mission Impossible?
He'd be this great secretary. He'd be a great secretary. Begrudgingly,
Charles Grodin Mission Impossible would be like, "Can I be 6?"
Yeah. He'd be questioning everything. Yeah.
Well, if there's no 6 and there's no 5, am I just 7 because you made me 7?
Yes. Do we need to run to a plane? You know.
You know, actually, I won't have a martini. Drinking is bad for you.
Yes.
This has been Midnight Run Through with Blake Howard and Jen Johans. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then...
See you in the next life. See you in the next life.
Now to close, here's the trailer for Night Owls, starring Adam Pally, written and directed by Charles Hood.
Yeah.
Hey, Peter.
I'm in Will's house.
Okay. Well, you need to explain to me why you're there.
After you guys left the banquet, I met this girl, and then I went back to her house.
Want to go upstairs?
Hello? Lady? Only problem is it's not her house. It's Will's house.
Where is she now?
I have to call you back.
No.
Lady! Oh, God. Hey, get up! Oh. Did you take something? Oh! Hi, doctor. Thank you so much.
We're not out of the woods yet. You're just going to have to keep her awake.
Keep her awake? What happens if she falls asleep?
Well, then her brain will stop sending the signal to her lungs that she needs to breathe. But you're not going to let that happen, so we have to worry about that, do we?
I would like to know why we are in my boss's house.
Don't let her talk to anyone.
That's for you.
And don't let her leave. That might be a bit of a challenge.
I am begging you, do not back out of this room.
Dude, let go.
How's it going there, champ?
You know, I think I'm pretty good. Everything seems to be under control.